Hey, wonderfuls, welcome to episode 408 of the podcast with my guest, Annabelle Gurwitch. I have known Annabelle for many years. We have talked about this podcast episode happening for many years, and I am so pleased to finally bring it to you. She has a new podcast on the Max Fun Network called Tiny Victories with Laura House, and it's such a great idea. I love that they're doing it. It feels just right for right now, and I also was a fan of Annabelle's when she was on a show called Dinner and a Movie, which I later ended up joining the cast of, so there is a nice roundness to all of this. I welcome you in. I hope you enjoy the episode, and I'll talk to you soon. Okay, so let's do a thing where I'm going to go I don't know what that was, that crackling, sparkling beverage that I assume is sparkling that just opened.
Yes, I put it under a blanket. Sorry about that.
What? Sounded. Oh, about the sound? Oh, I don't care about that.
Yes.
Oh, no. I just that's such a specific visceral sound.
Isn't it?
What
that's
is it?
That's my wine. A wine cooler. I'm just kidding. What if I'm so disappointed
that you're kidding. Oh, God. Oh.
It's a LaCroix. But what if I did say, it's a Bartle and James wine cooler?
I would only want to talk about that the entire time. Because, that's the kind of thing that, first of all, I would say you of all people could get away with that and make it something charming and jumpstart a revolution women. Yeah. Non-child women being I'm taking it back. It's a delicious, it's like sangria, but it's got a little bit of a sparkle to it. Come on, everybody.
And it comes in a can.
And it comes in a can. White cooler. Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. Now I'm getting into it because teenage years, but,
yes.
Was that a real go-to for you? Cause for me, it was not a go-to. It was I think even in high school, the people I was hanging out with, turned their noses up. They scoffed. It was let's drop acid and drink vodka.
I'm kidding. Wine cooler, I would have been, laughed out of the... Well, first of all, I was not a cool girl in high school. I just want to make that clear. I was, in that, funky theater group, right? There was this one brief shining moment in high school when I had the right haircut. Now, I'm a little bit older than you, so the haircut that I'm referring to is the Farrah Fawcett winged thing, right?
Oh, yes.
So if you had the right haircut, and I grew up in Miami Beach, so you had to have, it was like a trifecta of things. You had to have the Farrah Fawcett winged haircut, you had to be tan, and you had to have jeans that laced up the front and the back.
Oh, these God, help us all.
This very important, very important trifecta. And I had the jeans. I would sit there in my backyard with baby oil and a reflecting thing.
And you're a pale person, as am I.
I am.
Did it result in tanning, or did it just how often did it lobster? Just straight lobster, did you tan successfully?
I am zero to lobster really fast.
Yeah.
But
yeah, me too.
I was very disciplined about it, and this is hilarious because I'm not disciplined about anything. But at that moment, I got the golden tan. This is one moment in time, okay? And the Farrah Fawcett haircut, I didn't have it exactly down. So what you're supposed to have is wings. What I had was more like a chipmunk. I had a curtain. It opened and closed like a curtain. It didn't really wing. It wasn't feathery. It was a chipmunky curtain thing. But it was just good enough. Janet, I was voted to the homecoming queen, the queen, homecoming queen court. I was a princess in the court. But But here's what happened. This is why it was a brief shining moment. So, you know, I was this drama girl, you know, doing the plays and stuff like that. So I had a place in my high school hierarchy. But that moment, I was like, oh, sort of in the threatening to be popular moment. And in the yearbook that year, you can see me in a gown posing in the homecoming court. But what happened in actual life was, in between the time that I was, you know, like nominated and won, and I was also like, I won like class secretary that year as well, because I'm telling you, it was all the hair, even chipmunky, it was pretty good, and the jeans, hair, jeans, tan. So
right.
Between the time the picture was taken and the actual like event at a football game where we were all supposed to trot out like the homecoming court, I discovered pot or weed or marijuana. I was so stoned the night of the homecoming court, I couldn't find the football field. I never made it.
No,
out.
No. That's wonderful.
Never,
oh, that's wonderful.
Never made it out there. Never made it out. And oh. Then something else happened. So growing up in Miami Beach, very late 70s, my neighbors were the Bee Gees, okay? So it's so crazy because the Bee Gee documentary is really big now and people are once again thinking like, oh, the Bee Gees, they were so great. No one needed to tell us that in Miami Beach in 1970, like 8 or 9. Like I took disco dancing lessons, okay?
Oh my God, of course you could take lessons. It never occurred to me until this moment.
Of course you could. And I took them with my then boyfriend, who is now currently the mayor of Miami Beach. Okay. So we used to go and watch the movie Saturday Night Fever over and over in the theaters, get up and dance, right? Along with the movie. We were like so into it. And then we would sit on the top of somebody's Camaro. You had to have a Camaro in high school. I didn't have a Camaro, but other people had Camaros, right? That was the car, like the Dazed and Confused car.
Sure.
We would sit. I mean, can you imagine how the Bee Gees actually felt about this? We would sit in our Camaros or on the Camaros and play Bee Gees soundtracks in our cars loud in front of their houses. I don't really know why we did this.
I have so many questions.
And then,
I have so many questions.
And then, like, it was like they were like, you know, Miami Beach was not full. It wasn't like L.A., you know, where, like, you know, you run into people. Like, I live near the Rock and Roll Ralphs. You know, that's the grocery store where you regularly see people in bands, of course, in the before times when we all, you know,
sure.
were going to grocery stores. So, but in Miami Beach, this was not the case. But, you know, people in my high school would be like, oh, someone had a job at the local pharmacy. And they'd be like, I sold condoms to Robin Gibbs. You know, it was like a whole, like they were part of our lives. And in fact, the Bee Gees donated acoustic curtains to the Miami Beach Senior High School Rock Ensemble, which I was part of. I sang in this rock band. And let me just say, I can't sing. I don't know. I just thought the whole thing was cool. We had these like sequin tube tops we wore. I had a double perm. By that point, I had given up.
A double perm? Wait, what makes a double perm a double perm?
Okay. So I'd given up by then, you know, once I found, you know, weed, I'd given up the chipmunk hair. I was like straight on rock ensemble, totally into this like rock band thing. Bee Gees gave us our curtains. The double perm was, if you saw a working girl, what Melanie Griffith had. So it wasn't okay. enough to have, and I hope anyone who's listening will go, if you Google me, you can actually find pictures of me with a double perm, because that double perm actually lasted embarrassingly into the 90s when okay. I was the anchor of not necessarily the news. It's so humiliating on HBO. So the double perm was like, it's not good enough to have curly hair. No, it has to have a kind of, well, it's like a Jufro. It's like, if you don't have a natural Jufro, you need this like Brillo pad kind right. of Jewishy hair that I didn't quite have. And so you take that perm and you do it again and you fry the shit out of the hair.
It's a double perm. There's no,
it's a double perm. And once you double perm, by the way, you can't brush your hair. You can't even comb your hair. It just like, it has its own gravitational force. I mean, it was intense. A rat's nest. But I had that, and at the same time that I got the double perm, I discovered, and this was like one of these transformational moments in life. Like, okay, it had been Bee Gees, it had been the Farrah Fawcett haircut. A couple friends of mine got in someone's Camaro, and we drove to Fort Lauderdale from Miami Beach. It was like a 2-hour drive. To see a band that was playing that someone had heard of called The Ramones.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in this tiny club. There were like 200 or 300. I mean, I don't know. It was very small. And there's the Ramones, Joey Ramone, Dee Dee Ramone, Johnny, all the Ramones. They're pale, they're in their black leather motorcycle jackets, and they're singing their three-chord idiotic songs. And I was like, oh my God, what have I been doing with the tan, the jeans, and the perm? And I immediately just holed up, stopped going in the sun, just like started... It's so embarrassing. Like, I took all my clothes because I'm so punk, and I added safety pins to them.
Oh, yeah.
That was, come on. This man died. And then I like tore all my jeans. And at the time, let me just say, my family was like rich, poor, rich, poor, rich, poor. Really?
Okay. I want to get into this because when you say your neighbors with the Bee Gees, that raises some questions.
Let me just say, we were actually poor the whole time, but we pretended it was like a scam. But so I was driving to school in my mother's Mercedes, but I was punk. It was like so embarrassing, but that actually never left me. And then I moved to New York. I moved to go to NYU. Guess who was my on the block neighbor? Joey Ramone.
Oh my God.
And I've actually never really given up the my love of the Ramones and their sort of, I mean, I felt like when I heard the song I'm Against It by the Ramones, that became my life philosophy. I'm a Jewish person, but I'm really, I worship at the church of the I'm Against It Ramones. I mean, who ever said anything better than just, I'm against it. They weren't just against, a politician. They weren't against whatever political or they were just against it, all of it. And to me, I still feel I'm good with that. I have maintained that since age 18. I have maintained my fealty to the Ramones. I'm against it. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me ask these questions. I got to ask these questions. Okay. First of all, this is less a question than a comment, but I cannot believe there are so many phases of our American culture that have been unkind in terms of like how shit out of luck are you if you can't do this, don't look like this, don't have this. But that one you described is rough. Like, for me, you know, by the time I was in high school, like, you know, we were just wearing like long johns with like then men's boxer shorts over that with like a baggy extra, extra large shirt, a T-shirt, and then like a flannel, you know, that was just very like schlubby. Like our, it was cool to just be schlubby as hell. There was no focus for me in the world I was living in on like form or figure. I didn't have to have a tiny butt. I didn't, you know what I mean? Like
where did
the
you
idea
grow
of
up,
having
Jen?
To have Tucson, Arizona.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And so I just like my heart aches for the girls who in particular, I mean, there's so much that's hard about it, but in particular, the idea of like tight pants and, you know, skinny and feathered hair. Like, well, the hair definitely was, that's always, hair is always hard.
Oh, yes, the skinny thing was absolutely real because in the disco era too, like I wore a glitter tube top with like those like stretchy pants. Like they weren't pants, they were basically leggings. And you had to, you know, it required... If you, you know, it required some not eating.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Then I want to say, yes, you drop the bomb of living near the Bee Gees. First of all, and then of course, when you first said that in my mind, they all live in one big house together. 100% could not have, like, that's what I thought was happening. And then when you said their houses, I was like, okay. So they live near each other, possibly next door to each other, but they don't all live in one house like I was picturing up until you said that. was it quite posh? And what do you mind elaborating on the living outside of your means, going but then having to live within them
not
and
at
then
all.
Back
not,
and forth?
Not at all. So I wrote about this in the book Wherever You Go, There They Are. I wrote that book particularly is the stories, and this really relates to sort of this high school time because I didn't understand what was going on in my family till then because people don't, you know, you don't know necessarily, hey, your dad's a flim-flam guy until you're a certain age. So what happened was, you know, had been growing up, I was born in Alabama. We moved around the country a number of times. I never knew why we moved around the country until I was in high school. And I was, by that point, we were living on a gated private island in Miami Beach, Sunset Islands. Our neighbors were Howard Hughes and William
Not that you
Paley.
Ever saw him. Am I right, everybody?
Yeah, not that we ever saw.
Okay, great.
Exactly.
Cool. I know stuff.
Yeah, and the Bee Gees and deposed dictator Somoza. I mean, it was like, it was seriously intense kind of thing. So, you know, and I knew we had like the smallest house there. You know, like we had this cottage there on the interior of the island. We didn't live on the waterfront. People lived on the water I knew had more money. But still, this was a very tiny place. And we had come there after living in a plasticky, cheap, two-bedroom apartment in Wilmington, Delaware. And we had landed when I was in grade school in like paradise. The way I describe it is like, it's as though I'd been living in a black and white film and all of a sudden... life was in Technicolor. I had never even seen like fresh fruit. We were eating like, you know, like you do when you're a very middle class, working class family. Everything came from a can. Canned peaches, canned peas. I mean, up until then, my life was like lima beans and canned peaches and tuna surprise casserole.
Yeah.
We get to Miami Beach and all of a sudden there's like, I mean, this is how different the world was. Like, I had never seen mango. I didn't papaya. I didn't even know these things existed. I was like, what world is this? And that's when I entered this world of the girls who were tan and fit and they were cute. And in fact, Janet, when we first moved there and I was like 12, a neighbor knocked on our front door. I only heard about this again in high school. For years, I just, you know, I mean, as a kid, I didn't know what was going on. My mother told me when we first moved to Florida, a neighbor knocked on the door and it was a neighbor's mom. And she said, someone I was starting to befriend at school, she said, you have got to buy your daughter new clothes. she is not going to fit in here. She's wearing all these drab wool clothes that I had from Wilmington, Delaware. And she said, you have got to get her new clothes. My mother never got over that. Like, she was just so shamed by this.
Oh, my God.
I never knew this. But what was happening was my dad was basically a gambler in businesses. He would start and stop these businesses. And then whenever he would, like, owe money to everybody, we'd have to, like, and this is, of course, before the internet and everything was really traceable.
Right.
We would hightail it out of town. We moved out of Mobile in the middle of the night. I mean, like, it was like,
oh my God. You know.
And then
would you have siblings?
With my sister. And then we moved in with my mom's sister because we had no money. Like, we lost our house. We lost our businesses. I didn't know any of this, you know. It was like, it was all these adventures. And then we moved to Florida. My dad had a bunch of businesses, including at one point, he was a distributor of softcore porn movies. And at one point, they were put in my name and my sister's name.
Oh,
at one point, I owned the rights to the movie Poor White Trash, subtitled Scum of the Earth, Parts 1 and 2. The movie that did us in, because it was actually a good movie that my dad was the financier on, but it never made money, was a movie called, it starred Christopher Plummer.
Oh, okay.
And it was a movie that was called, I am blanking on this movie's name. Oh my God, this movie was like the worst thing that happened in my whole life up until then. It was called, I have to look it up because it's so embarrassing, because this movie made no money and that bankrupted my family in high school. And it was
the only decent movie that
my dad ever produced. Yeah. It's so crazy. And it was called,
Christopher Plummer would have been a great showbiz name had he gone into softcore porn.
Totally. I'm gonna think of it. But we were living in this place where we were surrounded by wealth. And but you know what check kiting is?
I feel like I can hazard a guess based on the term. But
okay. So, you know, basically my dad would float money from account to account.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it was this long sort of history of doing this. And so before things crashed, at times and sometimes he would make money, but then other times he would overspend it. He was a really interesting guy. He had fast food restaurants, a silver mine, softcore porn movies.
Uh-huh.
He had an insurance business. He owned radio stations. At one point, he tried to get the entire family, and this is in the late 60s, to invest in something that we would have really made money in, which was he came up with this idea in like 1968. This is before it existed, for pet health insurance.
Oh, there you go.
Because he was in head insurance company. And it was all a disaster. But, you know, so we lived in this place that we really couldn't afford. The house had like, oh God, at any given moment, there were like four mortgages. And so it was all this, you know.
How stressful.
Totally. It was really hard on my mom. However, at the same time, as it was really a terrible thing, it did give me this entrance into this world. I mean,
sure.
I had a really interesting childhood in that I was able to like travel in and out of all these worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And that allowed me to later, you know, feel strangely comfortable in any kind of situation because I had
that
been,
makes sense.
Yeah, I had, sure, visiting people in a blue collar crime prison, been there, done that.
Right.
staying at an old chateau in France, done that too. I'd done a lot of things.
Yeah.
Been poor and lived in a house with my aunt and uncle because we had nothing, done that. Like, I had a lot of experiences that were actually, you know, really interesting and made me feel like I fit into a lot of places because I had lived in a lot of different ways. But in general, I do not recommend that.
What was your relationship with your dad like when you were a teenager? Was he present? Was he always did he always have 80 plates in the air and he was not home much? Or what was your relationship like?
Oh, you know, you can read that book. The movie was called The Silent Partner. By the way, 1978, starred Elliot Gould as well. It's a fucking awesome movie.
Nice.
I highly recommend it. Just remember, it ruined my childhood. When you see it, enjoy, everybody. I had one relationship with my dad at the time, which was, I thought my dad was the most fun person in the entire world. You know, and then later I thought, this is so nuts. I had lots of changing relationships, which is how I ended up in going into theater and looking for other families. You know, I went into the theater world when I went to NYU and moved to New York to become an actress. And I just wanted to join someone else's family. And that's actually how I ended up in a cult as well, because I was just for a number of years, I wasn't in touch with my family. That ended. But I replaced my family with a cult at a certain point.
How old were you?
19.
You were 19 when you started to, when you joined. I guess you say,
yeah.
I mean, if there's one thing that the recent past has taught us, I think there's been more focus on a variety of cults from the past.
Yes.
I feel like that's been more present maybe in podcasting or documentaries, or maybe I'm just more interested. I'm not sure. It could just be that. But the whole sort of, you know what, I guess it's probably because of Nexium.
I mean,
that's really the thing
that's so fascinating.
That blew up.
Right.
Isn't it
right.
so fascinating? But
it's
how
so
did,
fascinating.
So is that, was that a situation where like any cult, I guess, you don't necessarily feel like that's what it is. You just feel like you found a group of people who more aptly define your values and stuff? Or did you go
on
doing
all.
This cult?
Not at all.
I'm interviewing different cults right now.
Nope.
What do you guys believe? Will I have to kill myself at any point?
Yeah. No, first of all, nope. I went into this thing wholeheartedly. And when I tell you what it was, you're going to... Oh, okay. So the thing was, I just want to make this caveat that... You can hear this story on The Moth. I told this story on The Moth. And I've written about it a number of times because I think people relate to this kind of thing. When you hear a story about someone who's been in a cult, you go, oh my God, I would never do that. And then when you kind of hear about it, you go, well, you know, I kind of understand it. And it's endlessly fascinating because I think it's everyone's worst fear that we would do something like this. And I did it. What it was when I was 19, and this was like the end of the, this was the fallout. I blame Christopher Plummer, basically. It's all his fault because if
poor
the movie
C. Plum.
Fucking Christopher Plummer, no. Because that movie tanked. I dropped out of college. My family had no money. And it shouldn't have been so sudden, but that's how I experienced it. I was so mad at my family. Wasn't talking to them. I met someone in New York, as you do. And let me just say, everybody was in a cult in New York at this moment. Everyone was in some kind of cult. You can't out-cult people in New York in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
So I met someone, a group of people that were so nice, and they were, and I still know some of them, let me just say. And the thing is, this, when people talk about a cult, there are actual definitions that people have come up with that are what a cult is. So they usually add, it's about money, it's about indoctrination, it's about feeling like you can't leave. There's like, there's all these thresholds.
Right, right. Yes.
So the group that I was part of was totally voluntary. No money was involved. But the reason why I call it a cult is because, and it's very possible, I was the only one in the cult, in the sense that I was the only one who might have believed every single thing we all said, because I was that kind of desperate person looking for a family. And I want to make that clear, because some people who are in that, who were in that group, have been mad at me. And I mean, people can think whatever they want, but, like, you know, it really wasn't a cult. No one made you be part of this group, right?
Right.
But it was so extreme that I don't know how to use, you know, okay, so it was a, this group was a group organized around someone who became like a father figure to me, who really was the dearest person and adored me. I adored him. He also happened to believe that he was the reincarnation of the pharaoh Akhenaten in the 18th dynasty in Egypt, and that everyone in this group was a reincarnation of someone in that royal family. We really believed this. We also believed we were in contact with these spirits through these psychic readings and this channeling. And we also believed we were in contact with aliens who were planning their first documented visit to the Earth, and that we would be returning to the home planet on a certain date. And I was preparing for that for a number of years. At the same time, I was pursuing a career as an actress. I had a job on a soap opera, okay?
Oh, my God.
I never told anybody this outside of that group. And nobody made me be in that group. You didn't. I mean, there was nothing like that. I chose to do this.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I will be back after a word from our wonderful buddies at Maximum Fun.
I can't hear myself, but I'm assuming.
These are real podcast listeners, not actors. Hey, thanks for coming. Here's a list of descriptors. What would you choose to describe the perfect podcast?
I mean, vulgarity.
Dumb. Definitely dumb.
And like, right here, this one, meritless.
What if I told you there was a podcast that did have all of that?
No.
Jordan, Jesse, Go. And it's free.
Jordan, Jesse, Go?
Jordan, Jesse, Go.
Jordan, Jesse, Go. A real podcast.
Let me ask you this. What, like, the people that were upset with you because of your use publicly of the word cult in the past, what would they have preferred you use?
Well, you know, it,
a collective, like, you know, what I mean? Like, what do you call that? I mean, I genuinely don't know, but.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so it was a new age group of seekers. To me, the idea is so extreme. So, yeah, maybe I should not use the word cult. It's just that for me, I was actually in a cult. It's because that's the whole thing, is other people in that group might have thought I was the youngest person in that group for most of the time, although a couple of younger people came in later. It was a very small group, let me just say. It may be that those people all thought it was all very quaint and, you know, oh, these things, they must have thought, oh, this is just for fun. I took it totally seriously. I mean, I was I would count in my bank account how much money I had, always making sure I had enough money to buy a plane ticket to get to the location in Greece where the pickup was going to take place by the aliens. I mean, I took this really seriously. Right. Now, the thing is, no one ever said, you know, it was not about like, we're going to all kill ourselves. I just can't imagine I would have done that. Right. I don't know if that had been posited, what I would have done. But that was not posited. That was never part of it. It was living and being. I mean, it was nothing like a death cult. It was just that it was so far-fetched from the reality I live now. It seems like I was another person. I mean,
I totally get it. I totally get it. And side note, I will say quickly that I fully believe I could join a cult. I'm not the person that is like, I cannot even, because I'm very empathetic and I have a lot of mirror neurons. And if I were around a group of people who all felt the same way and the sort of feedback loop of authenticity was present there, where we all felt so deeply and kept, you know, sort of regenerating new beliefs that were bouncing off each other, and it became more and more of this kind of world to live in. I don't look on people who join cults or, you know, who end up in cults or whatever. I don't really feel like, oh, you idiot. I don't feel that way. I just feel like humans are so malleable, and when we need something, when we are lacking something, or we're looking for a space to fill in our souls, there are pretty much anything's possible, you know?
You know, it's kind of funny, actually. I mean, when you said that, I think, well, you know, really what it was like a religious kind of group in, you know, in a certain sense. Like, you know, I don't think my experience is actually very analogous. You could say it's more analogous to people who were raised in Mormon church, you know, or raised in a very religious orthodox sect of Judaism. You know, these extreme beliefs. It's not, what difference is it really if you believe, if you accept, you know, that there were these tabernacles, gold tabernacles brought down to earth that were buried in the ground, dug up, and, you know, all the rituals of the Mormon church. I mean, really, and that all has to do with your future life and where you're going to be reunited later. So, I mean, it's really, I guess you could say it's even more analogous to that, you know, when you accept these very extreme beliefs, you know, and that all came out of my you know, childhood of like looking for family and then ending up in comedy. Because comedy is really cultish.
Comedy.
It, you know, like, you mean people who are Second City people versus people who were, you know, groundling people. I mean, I just remember at a certain point, you know, the groundlings aren't really doing improv. They're doing characters. I mean,
We all, the ways in which we all, especially at certain points in our lives, I think, like, need to feel like we belong to something. And then just as importantly, how are the ways in which that thing is more special or different or more fundamental than something that, you know, is not what you're doing? That's something else, something close, something like.
And the extreme ways that we give power over to somehow or another people who get, you know, are attracted to performing. You know, these people who founded Second City, even the Groundlings, and even just, you know, acting classes. I had acting class with Stella Adler's main teacher in New York, and he would say to me these things like, "You're the worst thing that could ever happen to the theater." Like, I mean, we allow people to say things to us like that to give them power, as if they are, you know, like, it's like a religion. You had to buy into the religion of Stella Adler at the Stella Adler studio.
Or like boot camp when you're in the military. I mean, just the ways in which you have to be indoctrinated so that you can, you know, that whatever the motivation for performing as a hive mind, so to speak, like that there has to be this sort of indoctrination or this, you know, this period of time in which your whole life needs to be this thing in order for it to stick or in order for that thing to be successful. And that can be that, you know, towards good things. It could be towards amoral things. It can be towards bad things. Like it can, you know what I mean? It could be, it could be anything.
I remember when I read Don DeLillo's book, Mao Too. I'm such a fan of Don DeLillo's book.
I am too. And so great.
So great. And in Mao Too, Don DeLillo wrote about the Sun Myung-moon and the Church of the Unification Church. And, you know, that was, he was that figure in that group where they would have those massive weddings where he would marry his followers who had never met before. They would go to these and they would get married. And then what one of the things I learned when I read that Don DeLillo book was that when the Sun Myung-moon's followers would go to, you know, raise money for the organization, which they got none of, basically. They would be sent out on the road in vans where they would basically, one of the techniques they had in sort of breaking down the idea of a personality and your individual agency was you didn't own anything yourself in those groups. So you would just share clothes, like they'd go to the laundromat, who's ever clothed, like they didn't even have their own underwear, you know, like and so
that's like Heaven's Gate kind of.
Yeah, but they would go out to sell flowers, you know, on these, and then they would, you know, go from town to town in these vans and, you know, raise money and everything. In some ways, it sounds a lot like the traveling companies of Second City.
I mean, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. And
sent out in vans, like everyone, like, I mean, my ex-husband was a Second City person and like, you know, like everyone wanted to be, in order to get on the main stage, you had to go to the touring and you'd go out in vans and you'd play these places, make very little money that they were bringing in. I'm not saying it was predatory because look, a lot of people came up that way, but it sounds an awful lot like Sun Myung-moon's Church of Unification, you know? And coincidentally, one of my dad's former secretaries or assistants that he had an affair with that I was his beard for later joined the Church of Unification, and I ran into her selling flowers on the street. Gosh. For Sun Myung-moon under a freeway overpass in Miami, bringing it full circle.
Oh my God, no kidding. Let me say this. First of all, yes. I knew that this could be a 6-hour conversation, and and we don't have that. But I will say that there are so many things that I can. That you're right in that you have done so much work, and you have you have such a body of work of writing behind you in addition to other things, but that you know I can point people to. And obviously you have a new book of essays that has just come out, which is You're Leaving When.
I do. You're Leaving When, Adventures in Downward Mobility. It lands on March 2nd, and that is a collection of essays that are motivated from if you've ever been in a moment in your life where it's been a, what the fuck just happened? Everything has changed, say like during a pandemic, and you've had to readjust to things. So those are all stories about remaking my life after my divorce. I became a landlady. I rent out rooms in my home. I had a kid who left home, went to college, went to rehab, and all these sort of experiences of this like sort of like a fallout from everything changing in my life. Some of these stories have been excerpted in the New York Times and LA Times. One of the stories I just want to send people to is a story. I accidentally became the 7th household in Los Angeles to participate in a bridge housing program where I hosted a couple experiencing homelessness in my
home.
That's
a great story, Annabelle. It's a great story.
I really hope people will read that. It was really one of those transformational experiences. And, of course, I really want people to laugh through all these stories. But there's a lot of serious topics that I try to poke fun of myself as I go through them. And, yeah, You're Leaving When is out. And then I have the new podcast, Tiny Victories, on our
same network, Tiny Victories. Yes, I love the concept of this podcast. It's you and Laura House, two women I have liked, known, and admired for many years. And it's a podcast that's a little bit more on the bite size side of things, which is kind of the whole point. And it's celebrating the small victories that you have, even if your life is a mess. It doesn't have to be a mess, but let's presume that many of us feel like our lives
I'm just starting at my life is a mess. That's my place where I always start. But the whole idea of Tiny Victories was that it's a tiny podcast. And
it's great.
So it's 15 minutes long. And we just try to highlight very small mercies, like things that you're never going to read about in the paper.
I love that. I love it.
We have a show coming up. I just want to mention to people about how a neighborhood was brought together in Silver Lake, near where we live, by some lost chickens. And I just love that poultry brought a neighborhood together. I love it.
I know. So. It's so good. And by the way, that wasn't me like rounding up anything, because obviously we're going to play our MASH game and all that kind of good stuff. But the reason that I brought it up when I did is that I did want to ask, just because you've had these many adventures. I mean, look, it seems like your dad kind of started the ball rolling in that way, right? Because I would never, even if I wanted to be as prolific as you've been, my stories would just be like, you know, they would... maybe I could make them vibrant and hilarious and strange by virtue of whatever, you know, my writing skills are or my perspective. But, you know, there are like empirical facts about things that you've gone through and experienced and either chosen or have had happen to you in your life that are extraordinary. When did you like, and you do have such a self-awareness of them, and you're very self-effacing about them, and you're willing to explore uncomfortable things, very personal things, things that, which I love, because that's, you know, kind of part of the purpose of this podcast for the last almost 9 years is this, you know, is sort of the universality of humility and just the things that we go through that maybe we don't like to talk about because they don't make us seem cool or whatever. When did you have, like, obviously I'm assuming comedy was a kind of an aha moment for you, because there is comedy sort of welcomes that introspection and that expression of the introspection. When did you start having like that? Did you always kind of have that self-awareness of like, I'm able to kind of see my life and my experiences from the outside as a writer can sometimes?
So, you know, it's funny what you just said, Jenna, because I have the sweet spot in comedy for me is something that you captured in the series, Everyone's Crazy But Us, right? There was an episode that you collaborated with a mutual friend of ours, Christy Mann, on, where your character is considering, you actually do this. You put an ingredient in food for your friend that's coming over who says she has an allergy, and you just don't fucking believe it. Uh-huh. And I just, and you want to test it out. And sure, you might kill her if it's true, but you just refuse to believe it. And that's a Kate Walsh, Dietrich Bader episode.
Yeah.
It's so fucking funny, and it's so uncomfortable. And yet I was totally with you, like, yeah, I think she should do that. It's like the underbelly of a person's psychology. And I love that. And so I have lived a lot of moments like that. And I'm interested in those moments. And so when I just started writing, which really surprised me, let me just say, I never intended to write. I was just an actress. I don't want to say just an actress. I was an actress for many years. I just never thought about writing. I just didn't have enough detachment to sort of even see the stories that I had. When I started writing, which happened just by accident, I happened to have made a connection with, I was working on a movie with Harry Shearer, you know, from this is Spinal Tap, and who had a show on NPR. I met through him people at NPR who basically, it's crazy, you know, invited me to be a commentator on NPR and write these commentaries. And because I had a really good editor there too, who sort of helped shape my idea of what I was interested in as a writer. I don't even know that kind of help exists anymore. I feel so lucky that I had this producer, Steve Proffitt, who helped me to shape what I was interested in and what I ended up being interested in. And this is remains through, you know, You're Leaving When is my fifth book now, which is really nutty.
That's great.
But what I'm always interested in is where my particular psychology meets whatever in the social zeitgeist. I don't actually think, you know, I'm so interesting or things that have happened to me are that unusual. I mean, there are some, yeah, I did have kind of a really kind of crazy childhood. And still, I feel like sometimes, I sometimes am in a position where, you know, pretty nutty things happen. But it's mostly for me about noticing patterns and a willingness to, I hope, reveal the most, what I think of as embarrassing to write to what we consider most shameful, you know, and then to sort of capture that within the cultural zeitgeist. That's what interests me. It's not like that I think I'm so special, but like, so for instance, like for me, what interests me is, and it always interested me as an actress, but then as a writer now, like I'll just look at moments like this. Like there's a story in my new book about this thing that happened. I bought a ticket for myself on kayak.com. I mean, you know, discount airline ticket to get from LA to go to Oakland. And I thought I was buying it on some like off-brand thing. It was less than $200, this ticket. I didn't know what, I never heard of this airline. I show up at this address, which was off-site from the airport. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm on like a medical transport. I'm going to have to fly carrying a kidney in ice, right? But no, Janet, it was a empty seat. It's called an empty leg. It's like an empty seat on a semi-private plane. So it's, I get to this hub and I'm like, holy fuck. I check in. I don't know what's going on. And I was the first person there and I'm alone in an airport hangar with a jet surrounded by red velvet ropes. And I'm like, holy shit, you know? And the whole thing is I am so against this kind of thing. I'm like a diehard environmentalist. I hosted a show on the Discovery Channel about lowering your ecological footprint. The reason why I was hosting that show was I was doing that in life. And I was deeply committed to this. I am like so against this kind of consumption of fuel in exactly... Well, less than 2 seconds, I went from an environmentalist to like, I'm flying like a boss. I was instantly that horrible person. This animus came out of myself. God. I was like, what do I have to do to always be in this world? I was like, okay, wait, here's the thing. There was no line for the ladies' room. I go into the bathroom and there's cut flowers, there's roses in the late of an airplane. I mean, it was like, it was so nuts. And I was immediately willing to give up all of my long-held values and ethics. And so, like, I write that story because That's what interests me of like, I think I'm a good person, but you know what?
Right.
I'm not, you know? And right. I'm just always, and so that's not like, oh, you know, the most extraordinary thing happened in the world. It was just this moment of recognition that I'm not the person I thought I was. And I feel like that's a relatable thing. And so telling the story, and I love little details. I mean, I just love details of like, if I can, like, this is where I guess I really turned into a writer a few years ago, where I just constantly am taking notes and just like trying to conjure an image for you. So like, here's like one of the telltale points of that story was like, I get on this like plane and I pull down the pull down tray. And you know how those are like these tinny things? And actually there have been studies that show that the dirtiest place in a plane isn't the bathroom. It's the pull down tray. You know, it's like a petri dish of disease. This tray was blonde polished wood with this grain, undulating grain, like a Mondrian painting. I tried to pull it off and put it in my carry-on bag. I was like a serial killer trying to just like get a souvenir.
Trophies, baby.
Trophies. I mean, it's like, and I just like feel like, you know, that's so if you're the kind of person who likes to like read, you know, like who finds that funny and wants to see moments of like horrible reckoning with yourself, you know, you'll like my work. If you're not, you know, go to Instagram. There are a lot of people with perfect bodies posting pictures of themselves
in
beautiful locations. Do that instead. You know,
that's
I'm not Instagram. That's the thing.
Yeah, no, so. I definitely, if it seemed like I was implying that you only write about things that no one can relate to because they're so crazy, that's
I didn't hear that. I just mean, it's funny because like there are these things that I do think are sort of like particular to my life. Like I do have some kind of, nutty luck of like, I would say nutty bad luck. of really weird things happening. Like I did write about like one of the adventures with my dad was we ended up in Los Angeles when he had this softcore porn thing. And I ended up at a nightclub in a ladies' room smoking angel dust with Danny Bonaducci, who lives two doors down from me now.
Oh my God. That's so nuts.
It's so nuts.
That's but, amazing. You
know, yeah. You know, just that.
Well, you know, listen, some of us sort of, you know, if you think of that as like people talk about coincidences or, you know, them being meaningful or not being meaningful, I tend to, you know, without any, I don't know that I'm like assigning a ton of deep, heavy significance or meaning, but I do sort of feel like when things come back around like that, it's just there's some part of me that chooses to think of that as like, well, whatever else is going on, I must be doing the right thing because I'm sort of getting these taps on the shoulder that are like, yeah, you know what? For sure, it's too weird that you now live two doors down from Danny Bonaducci. So you're doing something right because somehow this is like linking back up with a journey that you've been on this whole time. So
well,
that it's a sort of breadcrumb, a weird breadcrumb that's like, yeah, see, I'm doing okay. Here's this guy.
But I do know what you mean, and I do love that. And just by the way, if anyone listened to this doesn't know this, one of the really fun things about I am like embarrassingly your super fan is this, in case someone doesn't know this. So I started hosting Dinner in a Movie in 97 or 99, was before my kid was born. So I hosted that show for like 6 or 7 years. I can never remember. When I was fired from that show, a few women replaced me, including the amazingly talented Lisa Arch, and then you, and this, you know, in and you and I think both of you are fabulous. I love both of you. And what is, I think, you know, this is where choice comes into it too. You know, not like the universe is working for you. Like, you know, how do you choose to accept the things that happen also in your life through absolutely, you know, total, you know, no fault of your own or whatever, like, okay, I was fired from that job. And then am I going to think that the women who have taken over are like some kind of, I don't know, harridans, or am I going to worship them and try to get on their podcast because I love them so much? You know, I have chosen the latter.
Yeah.
So, but I'm such a huge fan of yours, and you know that we've been in touch over the years. And Lisa and I we love each other. I think, you know, at a certain point, also some of the like crazy little coincidences or things that happen because we decide, oh, this is how I'm going to go through this.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and I think it's just really fun that we can't, you know, not have, I don't know. I just think it's just really cool how we come together.
I agree. I mean, that is another reason that I started the podcast in the first place, was feeling like the last thing I wanted in a city that, you know, in a business that like breeds encouraging women to compete against each other and to feel threatened by one another, that, you know, I just didn't want to lean into that in any way, and I wanted to like be in violent opposition to it, and you know, have a podcast where I'm getting to know as many women in this city as possible, and getting to love them or like them or respect them, or just that the idea that, you know, that it's in defiance of this idea of like, well, there's just only so many jobs, so I guess you have to, you know, be pitted against each other, or, you know, that sort of vibe. And I've told you this, but, you know, when I lived in San Francisco and watched Dinner and a Movie and thought it was so wonderful and just was such a fan of yours and loved Paul and just loved the whole concept, I was as far away from the idea of being in show business as anyone can be. And so the most surreal thing and kind of the coolest thing about Dinner and a Movie was just that there was nothing else I did for quite some time that like was so representative of me as a fan having zero expectation ever in a million years that I would end up doing the version of that show that existed by the time I did it for also 6 years, which is so crazy. But so that, you know, that was, because it wasn't like, you know, it's not like I didn't watch that much television when I lived in San Francisco. And like I said, I was not planning on, you know, ever ending up in LA. And so it's not like I watched Friends and then I like came down to LA and got a role on Friends. Do you know what I mean? I have, yeah. but there was a thing that I was a fan of that I eventually ended up, you know, that when I came down to LA, it was kind of the first like consistent and larger job that I booked. And it just seemed crazy to me. That seemed crazy to me.
It is like, interesting.
This is, you know.
Like when these things happen, you know, as a writer, so I dropped out of college, as I have said, you know, because of Christopher Plummer, and God, I never had a chance to really dress him down about that. I'm just kidding.
I'm so sorry.
I love Christopher Plummer. I hope anyone who might be tuning into this halfway in the middle knows.
Plummer. Actually thinks that you have something personal against Christopher Plummer, they're beyond help.
But so, you know, I really taught myself to write, though, through reading, which you can do. I don't think that works the same with acting. I think acting, you have to, you know, but I think if you read enough good work and you start to read with a critical eye, and you're also writing at the same time, and you really, you can start to understand what's good and not good, at least that's how I had good editors, just by the way. But so there are some people that were really influential to me. And one of them is Barbara Ehrenreich. When I read Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickeled and Dimed, my mind was blown. And since then, you know, she's you know, written these books like Bright Sided. She has a new book out now where she is really, she really looks critically at society, and she writes with so much humor and intelligence. And the crazy thing is somehow or another, back when I did my book, my first book, which is a collection of essays about being fired, and it turned into a book which started from me being fired by Woody Allen to a look at the larger issue of the change to the gig economy. And I started, I reached out to Robert Reich, and I reached out to Ben Stein, and I reached out to all these different people, and I reached out to Barbara, and she became a friend and a mentor to me. And it's that same thing of like, you know, you know, maybe you didn't watch every show and then you ended up, you know, as part of a program you watch. Barbara was my most influential person who I thought, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to approach doing.
Yeah.
And then to have her be a colleague and a mentor and then a colleague of mine, it is really astounding. And it also speaks to a certain naivety of my own that I, you know, had I actually gone through a more traditional background of study and training, I might have been too intimidated to realize.
Yes, I think that's very astute. God. I agree. There are definitely things like that that we kind of back into because we don't. And I love that. I love the non-traditionality of that, that there can be a benefit to carving a really different path, or stumbling, or, you know, backing into something, or getting really excited about something totally outside of your purview, you know, in later in life, and still having it be meaningful and potentially having way more success at it than you would if you had just like been grinding out whatever thing you had to do, A to B to C to E. You know, I've never been able to live my life like that. I just never had anything that I was so sure I had to put everything I had into that, you know, that would have set me on a particular course. And there's most of the things I've done in my career have been sort of, you can't really, and you can draw a line, sure, but it's not like a straight line in any stretch of the, you know, the term. Like, it's just not. But I think if I had not done some of those things in this weird way, then I would have been like, oh, I couldn't possibly meet or talk to this person, or I couldn't reach out to this person. I would never be able to, you know.
Well, you know, it's funny because you asked me something about comedy, I think, earlier, and I just absolutely rolled right by that. And I did want to say, it is a funny thing. So I had one thing I wanted to do in life from the time, I mean, besides the Ramones and the perm, which I did achieve, you know,
double
you can
perm,
get a
baby.
Double. You know, I cross that off the bucket list.
That's
but
right.
there was, you know, since I was, you know, really, really little, I wanted to be an actress, and I had a very specific thing I wanted to do. I wanted to do really depressing plays. That's it. I can cry on cue. I'm not proud of this, but you know how some people like teach skills to their children, like life skills, cooking, you know, even algebra. I did not do that. I had cry-offs with my kid where I taught my kid to cry on cue. This is the one skill I have, Janet. And now, grasshopper, I shall pass this along to you. So, but I love depressing plays. I just could not get enough of depressing plays. I had a very early beginning in that. So, you know, as a kid, I was doing these community theater and theater with Temple Beth Shalom. I get to New York. And when I started NYU, I accidentally ended up auditioning for a play with the New York Shakespeare Festival at Joseph Papp's Theater off Broadway in a Jacobean tragedy. I got the job. I was 19 or 20 at the time. And it was a very serious, intense play. And I was like, you see, this is my future of intense Shakespearean, Jacobean tragedies. Well, I did all these very serious things. And then when I moved to LA to start, you know, I had an agent who, you know, wanted me to work in television. And I was like, okay, my best friend had just died of AIDS. It was all very, very like tragic, like most things in my life seemed to be at that time. I was just very focused on tragedy. Mm-hmm. I got out to LA and I read for a role on Murphy Brown, a guest star, as Candace Bergen's secretary. Now, it just so happened that that secretary was the role. The show had just started. I had never seen it. So this character was someone who took acting so seriously that she came to work in character as Eliza Doolittle and Maggie on Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. Well, I'm really good at accents. That's just something I'm good at. And I take myself so seriously as an actress. I got that role. It's funny because Candace Bergen, years later, she wrote in her book that I was one of her three favorite secretaries ever.
I love it. And I'm not surprised.
People assumed I was this comedy person. And mm-hmm. from then on, I could mm-hmm. not get a job in a serious show.
Girl, I feel you.
Comedy. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing. It was like I was suddenly, oh, she's a comedic actress. One job changed yep. that trajectory. And all I did in that job was take acting very seriously, you know? And then yeah. I had to sort of figure out, how am I going to do this? And then like when Dinner and a Movie came along, which was, you know, I think we both felt this. Fans of that show had a very personal relationship with us yeah. because we're using our names. And it was just such a kooky, ridiculous program that was just fun, out of the box. Yeah. And it was so guileless, like, you know, yes, there was no, yeah. we were not trying to pretend to be any kind of hosts with any kind of knowledge. We're just yeah. having fun.
Yes.
So I think people really connected to both of us and to Lisa. I mean, they felt very personal about us. Yeah. But like, I didn't know, like, was this comedy? I mean, I really and truly, I fell into comedy. I was not a groundling. I wasn't a Second City person. I had taken some sketch classes, but I was terrible at it. I mean, I was not that person. It was a total accident. And, you know, and maybe there is something good that is sort of a thought about, you know, look, all of the creative arts, they're all linked in a certain way. And of an exploration of humanity, trying to tell stories and create empathy by understanding sure. other people and be entertaining. And, you know, but it is funny, though, that you can find yourself in an iteration of that that is completely unexpected. And yeah. and there is something good, I think, to be valued about sort of being open to the yeah. chanciness of that
yeah,
and
exactly.
sort of the... And that actually translates to just so many other things in life as well. Being, you know, my co-host on Tiny Victories and your pal as well, Laura House. Laura had this thing. We talked about New Year's resolutions for 2021. And I'm not a resolution person, but I love when she told me hers. I said, okay, I'm glomming onto yours too. I think glomming is a great high school JV word. Glomming. I'm glomming onto yours too, right? Twinsies. I'm going to wear the same thing you're wearing. So she said her watchwords for 2021 are stay curious. I love that.
Yeah, that's great.
I think that's really good about for any artist, for any human,
yeah.
for anyone trying to survive this pandemic and
yep.
get through it. Like, stay curious.
Yeah.
Like, how am I going to get through this? How do I make this work? How do I continue my career when maybe your career has been bumped by the pandemic or whatever?
Right.
Those are really good words. And as I'm saying them, I'm reminding myself because I'm not always good. I always want to, I can be very rigid. So I'm reminding myself, stay curious, lady, stay curious.
Oh, it's time for a quick break. I will be back after a word from our friends at Maximum Fun.
Hi.
Are you someone who thinks that when one door closes, another one opens?
Someone who always sees the light at the end of the tunnel.
If you answered yes to one or both of these questions, good for you.
We are not those people.
Nope. I'm Annabelle Gurwitch, and I'm a, you know that other door opening? It probably leads to a broom closet kind of person.
And I'm Laura House. When I see a light at the end of a tunnel, I assume it's a train headed right toward me.
Laura and I have created a brand new podcast for people like us. It's called Tiny Victories. We're sharing personal tiny victories or things we've read or seen that inspire resilience.
So if you're looking for a tiny reason to get out of bed each week, subscribe to Tiny Victories.
Available on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get tiny.
I got to get into this MASH game with you, but...
Okay, yes.
So let's do our first category. Let's do three very depressing plays or movies that we are going to alternate universe kind of drop you into that you get to be in that for any number of reasons you probably won't end up doing, or even if you think you will. Three very somber works that we are going to plop you into so that you can have that experience of doing something.
Okay, got it. First is Streetcar Named Desire. I'm Great. Blanche DuBois, and my life is a fucking nightmare. All my dreams have gone through the sieve, and they're taking me off to the institution. But I think the doctor is my date.
Gorgeous. What's number two?
Number two is this new George Clooney movie, which is called Midnight Sky, which is supposed to also be, I think, a little inspirational. It's not. It's the end of the world, people. He is hallucinating about a child that he never met. And his life is over. And he's trying to do one last good deed for people, the last humans in existence.
Right.
And he leaves the comfort of his, you know, last station to try to do a good deed for them. No, I'm going to change that ending. I am George Clooney in Midnight Sky. I'm staying in the station and just drinking all the whiskey that's left.
Great. Great. Beautiful. What's number three?
Number three is let's see. Number three is Fleabag. Fleabag.
Yeah.
I know that might sound surprising. Fleabag is not, well, I mean, it's everything, right? Fleabag is all the things.
Right.
And, you know, who is greater than Phoebe Bridges?
I know.
And I'm going to take 1 second out of my lifelong commitment to say, I want to uplift the work of everyone, and I applaud everyone's work and how great they're doing, and just give in for just one moment to turn Fleabag into the worst thing ever, because I'm so fucking pissed off that Phoebe Bridges is so good at everything that I just want to push her in front of a truck on the show, not
what
in real life.
It's a huge compliment.
On the show, I just want to say, I wish her well, but on the show, because she also is the person behind Killing Eve.
Yeah.
What the fuck, lady?
I know.
Leave a little bit of like, you know, of like brilliance could for someone else. So for me, Fleabag is a tragedy because I will never, ever, ever achieve anything like that. Thanks, Phoebe.
Yeah, great. Great. That's like, I get, my dad loves to tell the story about him, his recognition of like Brian Wilson's like saying he wanted to sort of make the perfect album, and then he heard Revolver or something like that and was like, well, it's already been done. My life is over. Okay, next category. Let's do three writers from any time in history to the present that you get to collaborate on something with.
Okay. This is going to just sound terrible, but first, Virginia Woolf. And I know a lot of people would say that. And I love Virginia Woolf so much, except I never get past the whole novel. I can't read the whole book. I've never read an entire book of Virginia Woolf's. And I would just say, Virginia, why so wordy? Can we just work on like a good sentence? I know. It's just a sacrosanct. It's just terrible.
No, I love it.
It's just
I love
terrible.
It. That's what but this game is for.
I would write a very short one page tone poem with Virginia Woolf.
Great.
For one.
Great.
I would want to collaborate with Elena Ferrante, who wrote My Brilliant Friend and The Lying Lives of Adults. And the way I want to collaborate with her is to say, lady, you write for me.
Great. Go.
Yeah. It's a little one-sided, but I just think she does it better. So I just right. And then thirdly, I do have this worshipful relationship with Roz Chast, the cartoonist.
Yep,
and
yep.
Partially that's because I could never, I don't understand what she does. Like, it's alchemy to me that she's so funny and she's so brilliant, and then she also draws too. Like,
yeah.
I just don't understand it. And I have been in the same room with her. We were both nominated for a Thurber Prize for American Writing, and neither of us won, you know. And of course, she's won so many other awards, it didn't matter to her. I cried. She was like, another day in the life of Roz Chast. Who cares? But I would like to just... okay, this is all going to sound. This is sounding like that Stephen King novel with
Misery.
Kathy. Misery.
Okay. Okay. Are you going to make her write for you?
No, I'm going to lock her in a cabin with me.
Great.
In the woods, we're going to quarantine first, people. I don't wish Roz Chast ill. We're going to quarantine, then I'm going to lock her in a cabin, and I am going to sit there with her for as long as it takes to understand how she can be so, like, how her process of distilling. This is what I think she's such a genius at. She distills things down to one-frame cartoons.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
Wow. I'm a wordy person, if you haven't noticed, people out there. And I don't know how she does that. And I want to do that. So I would sit with her. Okay, it's a hostage situation. That's what I want to know. How do you edit down to one frame?
Great. Great, great, great. Okay, next category, three foods that in this reality are either sort of ecologically irresponsible, or you're allergic, or it's too fatty, or there's so much sugar that you feel like you're going to have a heart attack when you're eating it. In this reality we're creating, all things are equal and nothing is bad. And so you can have whatever this is in perpetuity, no matter how rare or how awful or how fill in the blank. Three.
Okay, terrific. This is so obvious. So I'm Southern, born in Alabama. The three foods that are my pyramid of food groups are chicken fried steak, steak fried chicken, and just fried, just the breading. If I could just live on those three things, I'd be happy.
Great. day. And fried. Fantastic. Okay, this is MASH. We're going to have a romance category. It's just how it's done. Three people, I don't care if they're characters from books, mm-hmm. movies, cartoons, animals, space people, whatever you want from any era, any age. It can be, you know, this actor from this era of their career. The sky's the limit. You three.
Okay. Viggo Mortensen. Even Viggo Mortensen, when he was in his barefoot phase, which is just stupid. He was walking around London barefoot for a while.
Yeah.
I don't care. I just, what can I say? Love Viggo Mortensen.
Great.
Okay. This is going to sound a little troubling. Mr. Snuffleupagus.
Great.
On Sesame Street.
Great.
You know, Snuffy is a very giving soul.
Yeah, yeah.
And I appreciate that in a partner.
Fantastic. Also, those eyelashes seem like they could feel feathery and fabulous just about anywhere.
The eyelashes. And if you really want to go down a weird rabbit hole, I was actually on Sesame Street when I was 19. I worked in the library on the show, and I did scenes with Actually, it wasn't Mr. Snuffy, just Snuffy. And
Snuffy.
I found Snuffy strangely a turn on. I know it's not appropriate, people. Don't think about it too hard.
I love it.
And lastly, I'm going to say, I have a big crush on the actress who plays the gay agent in Call My Agent on the French Netflix series. I think her name is Camille Cotin, and I just have a huge crush on her.
I got to look her up. Fantastic.
Yep.
Beautiful. Okay. Second to last
I might want her to be my agent. I'm not sure if I want her. All right. I'm not sure if it's sexual or professional, but I'll take both.
I think that's great. I think that's great. It's a good use of the category.
Thank you.
Okay. Next category, three places in the world that we are going to sort of be able to teleport you to, and you will have a second home.
Oh, yes. Well, I would like to live in one of the hot springs, those in Iceland. I've always wanted to go there. I still intend to go there. Then I want to go to the hot springs in Japan. That there's a species of monkeys that sit in the hot springs with you.
Oh yeah, that's right. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, so cool. And then I want to go over to Beverly Hot Springs, which is in my neighborhood in Korea, near Koreatown in Los Angeles. There's a theme here.
Wait, I'm giving you a second home inside Beverly Hot Springs?
Yes.
I love it.
I've picked three locations of natural bubbling up places of hot water from the earth. And That's where I want to go. I know it's a little matchy-matchy, but
I support it entirely.
What's great about it is I can wear the same thing to all of them. A bathrobe, which I take off and then go in naked into the hot springs. It's
so
easy.
It just makes good sense. It just makes damn good sense.
When you send me off there, when you teleport me there, Janet, I don't have to bring luggage.
No, you don't.
I'll go in my bathrobe. I love traveling light.
That's right. And zero carbon footprint.
Okay.
Next one, next and final one is three next door neighbor musicians that you would like to have to complete your collection of having lived close to many other singer-songwriters. If you could choose... Three different, it could be a whole band, it could be a singer-songwriter, it could even be a composer if you want to go that route. And presumably them being your neighbor also involves you getting to like sort of go over and like listen to music, or maybe they compose a whole album that's just, you know, sort of for you, like curated for you in your life. Three next door neighbor musicians.
I like it. Okay. So my choices are first is François Couperin. I love Couperin's music. That's early music or Baroque music. That just makes me really happy. I would yell over from my fence to Couperin's fence, "Hey, Coop, baby.
Great.
I'm writing now. Could you please turn on the Baroque? Crank out the Baroque for me. It really makes my brain happy."
Great.
So I got Couperin on one side. Then I've got 100 Gex on the other side.
Okay.
100 Gex is experimental, electronic, nightcore. There's a lot of different ways to describe it. Basically, I call it my migraine.
Okay.
And the thing about 100 Gex is the music just does something to my brain that's so awful that it makes me happy.
Wow. All
I can say is if you haven't listened to 100 Gex, that means you don't have a 22-year-old child
right.
who hasn't told you to listen to it. I urge you that I would love that because somehow that music just makes me super happy. So I've got Couperin, I've got 100 Gex, and right in the middle, I've got Sufjan Stevens.
Great.
And Sufjan Stevens, what I do with Sufjan is, and I'm probably pronouncing his name wrong. Sorry.
I think you're pronouncing it right.
Ooh, very
but
good.
But maybe not.
What I say is, hey, buddy, I need someone to just whisper in my ear little songs, little songs to just make my day go better. And he does that. He does little songs like that, and that just makes me happy. So
I love it.
That's my trifecta.
I love it. Okay, here's how we determine what you end up with from each of these categories, and you're 100% guaranteed MASH future. Why don't you tell me what the color of your mood is right now?
Well,
I've never asked anyone this question before in my life.
I'm so glad you asked this because I have a new episode of Tiny Victories that's all about the influence of color on mood.
Oh my God. I'm amazing. Fantastic.
So, Janet, the Pantone Color Institute color of the year for 2021 is the color of Amanda Gorman's coat that she gave the speech in at the inauguration. And that coat might seem like yellow, but it is not. It is a color that is they call illuminating.
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 Illuminating, okay.
And it's this beautiful yellow. It's a yellow that makes you stop and say, "Hey, is that a banana? Or is that the brightest sun I've ever seen? Is that the Morton Salt girl?" It just wakes you up, right? Like a daffodil. And my color is illuminating.
Okay, great. Will you please reiterate to the listener the places they can find you? We've talked about it. Let's put it all in one place here while I do these very rudimentary calculations, and then I will have the answer to your MASH.
I can't imagine what kind of calculations you're doing. You can find me on Twitter at LA Gerwich, and I'm going to have the dates, upcoming tour dates. We've got events with Marissa Tomei and Andy McDowell and Dave Barry and just all kinds of fun things coming up for the book. I'll put those dates on Twitter. You can find me on the Facebook at Annabelle Gerwich Author if you dare to give Mark Zuckerberg your business. I do find that useful. And you can find Tiny Victories on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, or on the Maximum Fun website. And I hope that you will call our Tiny Victories hotline, because that's really my favorite part of the podcast, is when people call in their tiny victories. And I am going to give you that phone number.
Oh, yeah,
please do. Phone number for the Tiny Victories hotline, which, by the way, rings on my computer, which is kind of hilarious. I don't know how to turn it off. So every time someone calls it, it's kind of nutty, but it rings on my computer. And that number is 323-285-1675. That's the Tiny Victory hotline. So find me there. Find me on Twitter. Find me on the Facebook. One day I'm going to get it. On Instagram. I'm not right now.
I'm very bad at managing social media. I'm very bad at it. I don't live on social media. I have
don't
to be reminded.
Either.
Okay. I have your results. I feel very good about them. I hope you'll feel the same. I first want to say that I think what's fitting for the Tiny Victories podcast, in sort of in conjunction, a companion piece, if you will, is your one page with Virginia Woolf. I feel like that is a nice, nice tie-in. You're going to have that beautiful one-page poem, I believe you said, with Virginia Woolf. So that's going to be an additive to the literary oeuvre.
People would thank us.
I agree. I want to lean into the French theme that has happened with two of these answers. I don't know if she's your agent, your lover, or both, but you have the adorable agent from Call My Agent in your life in a very meaningful way.
Yes.
And you have François Couperon, on your speed dial as well. And you can also just like crawl, just as you said, call across the backyard, however you please. You have him as a neighbor and as a friend and composer in your world. That feels like maybe, you know, as you're getting into the mood for your role as Blanche, also a French name, in Streetcar, maybe, you know, during your sort of like emotional prep, maybe even François Couperon gives you like some music that sort of helps you get deep into the Blanche state of Blanche DuBois. You are going to, you're going to do that that play. I'm sure we could agree it's going to be miraculous and fantastic and wonderful, but it's also going to be very taxing. So you're going to want to take a nice long soak at your very own house that is right there in Japan, where the hot springs and the monkeys come together to soak. I don't know if you want to be eating chicken fried steak right there with the monkeys in the hot springs in Japan.
Could be dangerous.
If you so choose, you have it in unlimited quantities, whenever you want, with zero ramifications. Well done, you.
Oh, Janet, I feel like this must be something to do with the pandemic, but just even you're saying those things
feels real, doesn't it?
It does feel real, because you also say it with authority. I also feel like anything could happen. I think we have seen in this pandemic, like, it's been so far from our imagination of what our life could be like. When you just said that, I sort of felt like, that could happen.
That's exactly right.
Who knows?
That's exactly right. It's the right response. I'm so glad we finally got to do this. I definitely encourage everyone to go to all the places, rewind. Feel free to rewind this podcast if you need to listen to those places again. We'll also put some links in the show notes. And everybody, please take care of yourself. Be safe. Wear a mask. And I will talk to you next time on the podcast. The show is recorded by me and edited by Julian Burrell. And as always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
Hey, remember when we could save kittens from trees or lunch
on skyscrapers. Bring the villains to their knees. Maybe we should move someplace new. And they'll time see.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.